They ate a lavish dinner at Maxwell's Plum. They saw a baseball game at Yankee Stadium. Then, when the weekend was over, Candy flew back to California, and Jeffrey McDonald flew to Raleigh, alone, to stand trial for the murder of his wife and children, murders that had been committed almost 9.5 years before. Chapter 2. In early June, Bernie Siegel had written Jeffrey McDonald a letter. "Dear Jeff, I'm a little concerned about your wardrobe for the trial. The most important matter is for you, one, not to convey a Southern California image, too much suntan, polyester, and beachy colors. Two, that you not appear to be too casual about the whole matter. The world needs to see you looking somber, serious, burdened, and even concerned about this trial. And three, that you do appear to be, at least as to your looks, truthful, reliable, and responsible." Siegel was also concerned about the jury. At a cost of $15,000, he employed a Duke University psychology professor to assemble a demographic profile of the ideal juror. The professor's staff made more than 900 random phone calls, asking responders such general questions as whether they believed people in military service were more likely to commit violent crimes than civilians, whether they felt doctors made too much money, and whether they accepted the notion that a person who has an extramarital affair is not necessarily a bad person. In reference to the McDonald case specifically, those contacted were asked whether they had heard of it, 81% had, and whether they had formed an opinion about his guilt. 6% said he was certainly guilty. 29% said probably guilty. 33% said probably not guilty. 5% said certainly not guilty. And 27% said they did not know. The respondents were also asked a series of demographic questions pertaining to age, race, marital status, length of residence in the country, educational background, political affiliation, and regularity of church attendance. A subsequent analysis of the demographic and attitudinal responses disclosed the combinations most closely associated with a predisposition toward belief in innocence. The professor had then weighted each of the factors, much as a horse player will do when analyzing a field of thoroughbreds, and had devised a mathematical formula that would enable Siegel to evaluate each prospective juror quickly on the basis of responses to questions asked during the selection process. The surprising result of the survey, the professor from Duke said, on the Friday before jury selection was to begin, was that the ideal jury would be composed mainly of conservative whites over the age of 35. In most cases, just the kind of jury sought by the prosecution. "It's true," the professor conceded in the temporary office Siegel had acquired in downtown Raleigh. "What we want is the kind of typical good citizen that the government is probably going to go after. They won't be able to figure out what we're doing. In fact, they may think we've gone a little crazy. You know, normally you see an American flag in the lapel, you get rid of the guy. Here, that's just the type we're looking for." Jeffrey McDonald, who was at the meeting, shook his head. "I hope you're as good as your reputation," he said, "because everything you're saying goes against my gut feeling." I know," the professor said, "and I know that it's your life, not mine. But I'll tell you what," he continued, suddenly smiling. "If I'm wrong, I won't serve any time for you, but I promise I'll work for free on your appeal." Jeffrey McDonald glared at the man from Duke. Bernie Siegel quickly interceded, employing his most soothing tone. "Jeff, Jeff, relax. There's not going to be any appeal. We're going to pick a jury that will not only acquit you, but will come back and award punitive damages." "I hope you're right," McDonald said, getting up to leave the office, "because, frankly, this scares the hell out of me." Once the client had departed, the professor, who himself could be described as young and liberal, was able to speak with greater candor. "What Jeff doesn't understand," he said, gesturing toward his pile of statistical analysis, is that it's my friends we want most to get rid of. They all think he's guilty as hell. McDonald was living in a small room at one end of the second floor of the Kappa Alpha fraternity house on the campus of North Carolina State University. The house was occupied also by McDonald's mother, by Bernie Siegel, and by five other lawyers and legal assistants, including Mike Malley, the ex-Princeton roommate, now a corporate attorney in Phoenix, who had taken a leave of absence to work without pay in his old friend's behalf, as well as by four fraternity brothers who were remaining on campus for the summer. Siegel felt that Jeff would have a better chance for privacy at the college than he would in a downtown motel. The housing at Kappa Alpha had been arranged by Wade Smith, the local counsel whom Siegel had retained to assist him. An accomplished bluegrass musician who had been, in the late 1950s, a starting halfback on the University of North Carolina football team, Smith was a senior partner of the respected Raleigh firm of Farrington, Smith, and Hargrove, and the same attorney who had been recommended to McDonald by Allard Lowenstein in 1971. When Lowenstein had become convinced that McDonald was not a victim of military injustice, but rather a man in need of a good criminal lawyer. A native of the small North Carolina town of Albemarle, Wade Smith was a sturdy, gracious, exuberant man, and the father of two bright and attractive teenaged daughters, who were just a bit older than Kimberly and Kristen McDonald would have been had they lived. At 42, having recently retired undefeated from state politics after two terms in the legislature, Smith was, perhaps, the most renowned practitioner of his craft in the state. He also possessed, in uncommonly full measure, a combination of kindness and wit. Wade's the golden boy, Bernie Siegel had said. He's the best of what they have down here. It was neither Siegel nor Smith, however, who was on Jeffrey McDonald's mind when he reached the Kappa Alpha house late Friday afternoon. It was the jury selection man from Duke. McDonald did not speak about it right away. He changed into a pair of red gym shorts and, despite the heat and humidity, went out to run 5 miles around the North Carolina State University track. When he returned, he lifted weights for 20 minutes. Then he showered and put on a pair of white slacks and a t-shirt that said, California Breaststroking Team, Stroker. Then he opened a can of beer and looked up at the wall of the Kappa Alpha dining room, where a picture of the fraternity's most distinguished graduate member, J. Edgar Hoover, was hanging. What worries me, McDonald said, is that by our figures, he would be the ideal juror. On Saturday morning, July 14th, Jeffrey McDonald and his mother drove 25 miles to Chapel Hill to be interviewed by a new psychiatrist Bernie Siegel had hired. Robert Sadoff, the Philadelphia psychiatrist who had examined McDonald in 1970 and who had testified at both the Article 32 hearing and the grand jury proceeding, was prepared to do so again. But Siegel, a Jew from the urban Northeast, did not want to go before a Southern jury, however carefully chosen it might be, with only a Jewish psychiatrist from the urban Northeast to explain that Jeffrey McDonald could not possibly have killed his wife and children. He wanted a man from North Carolina to say the same thing. In Chapel Hill, at the University of North Carolina, he had located one with impeccable credentials, and the psychiatrist seemed willing to testify, pending his interview with the defendant and the defendant's mother. Siegel himself went on Saturday to the chambers of Judge Franklin Dupree to argue a series of pretrial motions. His relationship with the judge was not good. Since 1975, in fact, when Dupree had rejected Siegel's bid to have the indictment dismissed on constitutional grounds, and then had denied his request for a change of venue, he had considered the judge an enemy. "He is, in brief, an asshole," Siegel said at breakfast at the Kappa Alpha house on Saturday morning. "He is the pits, a despicably low individual. The problem is that he has all the proper mannerisms for a judge and manages to communicate a totally spurious aura of fairness. He may be a dummy, in other words, but he doesn't have a style that makes him easy to hate. Accompanied by Wade Smith, Siegel returned from the judge's chambers to the downtown office at 4 p.m. The temperature was 92 degrees and the humidity was 90%. It had been that way in Raleigh for a week. Siegel took off his suit jacket, dark pinstripes, loosened his tie, lit a cigar, opened a can of diet soda, and stared glumly and silently out the window. Wade Smith took a seat next to the desk. "How did it go?" asked Mike Malley, who had been working in the office all day. "Well, we won a few things," Smith said. "Nothing that would gladden anyone's heart, but it didn't go nearly as badly as it could have. I think he's beginning to understand that we're not bad guys. We didn't gain an awful lot on some points, but we did manage to get his attention. I had the feeling that the ice was melting just a bit. I believe he's starting to come around." Siegel, wreathed in cigar smoke, his feet on his desk, continued to stare out the window. "It was not a day to feel elated about," Smith continued, managing a smile, "or even greatly encouraged by. But neither should we feel discouraged." Bernie Siegel put his feet down, removed the cigar from his mouth, and swung slowly around in his chair. "Actually," he said, "it was a disaster. We didn't get the sweat from his armpits today." Judge Dupree had agreed that the jury could remain unsequestered and that prospective jurors could be questioned individually and not in groups, a point vital to the selection technique Siegel intended to employ. But since the prosecution had not opposed either of these motions, Siegel did not consider the judges granting them to be a victory. There had been, on the other hand, nothing ambiguous about Dupree's ruling on the motion that the defense be provided with a free copy of the daily trial transcript, something which otherwise would cost $1,000 per day. He had denied it. And when Siegel had argued that his client could not afford to pay for daily transcript, while the prosecution, backed by a limitless, taxpayer-funded expense account, of course, could, the judge had replied that Dr. McDonald did not strike him as an indigent defendant, and that, in fact, he had recently received a newspaper clipping from California describing a disco party designed to raise funds, presumably for just such a purpose as this. Even more ominous, from Siegel's point of view, had been the judge's announcement that he was reserving decision on the admissibility of certain points Siegel considered vital to the defense. These included references to the constitutional questions of speedy trial and double jeopardy, as well as mention of Helena Stokely's continuing admissions to others that she, whose whereabouts were currently unknown, believed herself to have been involved in the murders. Other points on which the judge had not yet made up his mind were whether the jury should be told of the report filed by Colonel Rock, which had found the charges against McDonald to be not true, and whether they should be informed of Dr. Sadoff's 1970 testimony that McDonald lacked the capacity to have committed the crimes. Indeed, the judge said, he was not at all certain that he would permit any psychiatrists to testify, since the question of insanity was not at issue, and since he believed that conflicting expert testimony tended to confuse a jury needlessly. Pending his later rulings on these matters, the judge had said, no mention of them would be permitted in the opening statement to be made by the defense. "So what's the status of our opening statement?" Mike Malley asked. "We don't have one," Bernie Siegel said. He looked out the office window again at the scorching summer sun and the stifling humid air that hung heavily over the somnolent southern city. He took another sip of his tab and another puff of his cigar. He said, "I guess we can talk about the weather." Soon, however, the three lawyers began to go to work. Whatever the judge's restrictions, an opening statement would have to be delivered within a week. Siegel's first decision was that Smith should be the person to deliver it. He wanted the jury's first impression to be of a familiar local presence. Siegel believed they would find this reassuring. Even if they did not know Wade Smith personally, the jurors would be more likely to give credence to words spoken in a cadence and with an accent to which they were already well attuned. Later, particularly during the cross-examination of government witnesses, there would be a place for Siegel's harshness and histrionics. But the folksy, gentle manner of the Raleigh lawyer, Siegel believed, would provide the most effective possible introduction to the version of events that Siegel wanted the jurors to accept. "I think," Siegel said to Smith, "that the first thing you'll want to suggest is that this is an unusual case. This is a crime that occurred more than 9 years ago. We have to hit that theme constantly. Enough is enough. Too much time has gone by. Then I think it's important to set the family scene. Here was a man 26 years old who had just completed medical school, achieving the dream of a lifetime. But before he embarked upon his career, he wanted to do service for his country. So there he was at Fort Bragg with his wife, his childhood sweetheart. I think it's important to mention, incidentally, that he had a partial scholarship and had to work to get himself through Princeton, that he came from a poor family, and that his mother and father both worked to help pay his way. Right from the start, we want to offset this image of him as a rich doctor from Southern California." Wade Smith was taking notes on a yellow legal pad. Mike Malley was sitting in silence. Working hard on his cigar, Siegel continued to build the scenario. "He does so well at Princeton that after only 3 years, he's accepted at medical school. He does so well there that he earns one of the top internships in the country. And at the end of that year, he agrees to serve his country as a Green Beret. Not because he's any sort of macho killer, but in order to help those who need help the most, the boys we sent to fight in Vietnam. Then you paint a picture of the peace and tranquility they enjoyed at Fort Bragg. Take it right up to Christmas. Tell how he bought the pony for his daughters. And if that doesn't get somebody a little lumpy at that point, we've picked the wrong jury." Siegel paused for a moment. "You might also stress," he said then, "that at Fort Bragg, for the first time, they did not have to scrimp for money. And," Mike Malley added, "that for the first time in their married life, they got to spend a lot of time together." "I'm not sure, Mike," Siegel said. "The cynical response to that is, yeah, and they found out they didn't like it. I don't think we ought to hit that note too hard. You see, the point is, as long as people do not see him as some California hip swinger, some money-grubbing doctor, he's halfway home to being acquitted." Wade Smith was nodding. This was a language he understood well. "Humanize him," Smith said. "Make the jurors want to embrace him." "Right," Siegel said. "After all, who's the government got to embrace? Freddie Kassab?" "And let's not leave out Colette," Siegel continued. "She was growing as a person, too. Even on the evening of February 16th, the last night of her life, she was going to a child psychology course, trying to better herself. Jeff stayed home and played with the kids, put them to bed. Parenting by the father, you see. A real good evening, just like so many others they'd enjoyed. Then, you will hear from the last person who saw her alive, the woman to whom she gave a ride to class, how Colette MacDonald felt about her life, her husband, her marriage. The human details. That loving scene between husband and wife as they have a drink, chat about the events of the day, enjoying the time that they considered their special time together. Then she goes to bed, he finishes the housework, reads a bit for relaxation, watches TV. For a moment, Bernie Siegel's eyes appeared to moisten. Then he said, "You might as well mention the bedwetting here. That makes it less ominous if the government tries to use it as a motive. And what were his choices? Either to wake his pregnant wife in order to remake the bed, or simply to go back to the couch so as not to disturb her as she slept, and to fall asleep on the couch himself, having no idea of what was about to befall him and the people he so dearly loved." Wade Smith was nodding and writing fast. Without missing a beat, he picked up where Siegel had paused. "You will learn of the intruders," he said. "You'll see them. You'll come face to face with them. Fine, Siegel said, although I think you'll want to be synoptic about the details of the struggle. And then we'll show you how and why the government has been so consistently misled in this case. And you'll learn how Jeff has tried over the years, Mike Malley said, to rebuild his life, only to be dragged back to face this. Yes, yes, Siegel said, getting up from behind his desk and starting to pace. And the fact that he's never remarried, that's very important. And continue with how the government has kept this alive for 9 years. Keep coming back to the 9 years. And I think it's really important that we promise to explain the errors that the government committed, what led them astray. At some point, Wade Smith said, looking up from his pad, they're going to learn that Jeff told Freddie a lie. How do you want to deal with that? He throws himself into his work as a means of forgetting, Siegel said, beginning to gesture expansively with his cigar. But all the while, one set of people will not let him forget, will not let him rebuild, will try to make him live in the past. Who is responsible? His stepfather-in-law, a fanatic, a man obsessed, a man named Alfred Kassab, a man who wanted to spend every weekend combing the bars of Fayetteville in search of the killers, doing what the Army, the CID, the FBI should have been doing. You will hear how Dr. McDonald tried to escape from the trap of living with this obsession, Mike Malley said. I think escape might not be a good word, Siegel said. All right, how he tried to free himself from this obsession. Incidentally, Smith asked, how do we refer to him? As Dr. McDonald? As Jeff, Siegel said. We want to humanize him. We want them thinking of him as just plain Jeff, the kind of guy they'd like to have for a next-door neighbor. And we want to contrast that with the image of the wicked stepfather, Freddie Kassab. He'd be your next-door neighbor, Malley said, smiling, if you happen to live in a waterfront condominium in Huntington Beach. We minimize that, Siegel said. What we emphasize is the fact that this trial represents an opportunity for the jury to put an end to 9 years of suffering. That the system is finally going to work, Smith said. We want them thinking, oh, the poor man, Siegel said. We want to put on them the full knowledge that they have the ability to relieve him of his suffering. And before this trial is over, Smith said, you will see the full dimension of this man. Decent, intelligent, hard-working, devoted to community service, capable of mistakes like the rest of us, but in 1970, not drunk, not on drugs, not mentally ill. We want them to feel a little sad at the end, Siegel said, a little sympathetic, but mostly a little cynical, suspicious of the government's case. Look at the man, Smith intoned. Look at the life that is supposed to have created this monstrous destruction. And then we hold the government's feet to the fire. They cannot prove he might have done it. They cannot prove he could have done it. They must prove, beyond any shadow of a doubt and to a moral certainty, that he did it. We need to stress the gore, Siegel said. You've got to feel the blood on the floor. Paint the crime scene monstrously. Knives, ice picks, clubs. Colette, both arms shattered. The children, 5 and 2, beaten and stabbed and battered in the most horribly sick way. Paint it monstrous, because we don't have a monstrous defendant. The jury will look at him and say, did he do that? And there's no way they'll believe it. I agree with you, Smith said, getting ready to leave. He was living not at the Kappa Alpha house, but at home. I'll present it as a kind of a down-home discussion, he said. We don't want to seem to be enjoying it, or in our glory. More that the sad moment has come, but now the jury has the opportunity to let Jeff return to California and live out the rest of his life in peace. To which Siegel did not respond, amen, but he did say, are you going to take Jeff to church with you tomorrow? I think so, Smith said. It can't hurt. It'll be restful and maybe a little inspirational. At least it will give him a look at some of our people, and he can see that folks here are not all out to get him. Smith departed. Siegel and Malley moved to an outer office, where Siegel's six assistants had been working all day. 10 minutes later, Jeffrey MacDonald and his mother arrived, just back from Chapel Hill. "Well?" MacDonald said. "Well, what?" Siegel said. "What happened?" "Nothing happened." "What do you mean, nothing happened? What happened with our motions? What happened with the judge?" "Jeff, I just told you. Nothing." "Okay, Mike, your turn. What happened?" "Like Bernie said, Jeff, nothing happened." "All right, how about any of the rest of you? Does anybody feel like telling me what the fuck is going on?" None of Bernie Siegel's assistants responded. "Jesus Christ," MacDonald said. "I'm paying for 11 fucking lawyers. You'd think one of them would have the courtesy to tell me something." He paused and looked around the room. Still, no one spoke. "Oh, I get it," MacDonald said. "It's a joke, like a surprise party. Any minute now you're going to tell me the judge threw the whole case out of court. It's all over. Case dismissed. I can go home. The champagne is coming up in the elevator. They're icing it now." "No, Jeff," Siegel said. "I'm afraid you're going to have to wait a few weeks for the champagne." Then he took MacDonald into his private office and broke the bad news about the judge's rulings. After that, to get it all out at once, he went on to explain that Wade Smith was going to make the opening statement. "You're not going to do the opening?" MacDonald said. "I can't believe it. You've had 9.5 years to get ready, and now you tell me, 2 days before the trial starts, that you're not even going to make the opening statement? Bernie, I flew 3,000 miles just to hear you. Come on now, give me a break." "Jeff, we have Wade. He's an asset. He has to be utilized. And his greatest strength is his personality. He doesn't know the case as I do, but he has the capacity to relate to people, and that's important. He'll be working from the scenario that I gave him. I walked it through for him this afternoon. Essentially, conceptually, it's mine. The only change is that Wade will deliver it instead of me." Siegel then outlined the essence of the statement for his client. Jeffrey MacDonald was still not pleased. "That sounds flat, Bernie. Very flat. There's no zingers in there. Not one zinger. I expected you to crucify them, not just tease them a little bit." "Jeff, the opening is just setting a tone. That's all it is. We have the whole trial to get in our zingers. And believe me, the tone will be good. Very low-key. Wade will be fine. He'll do it as well as it can be done." "Sure, sure," MacDonald said. "Don't bother, I know the rest. If he screws up, he'll work for free on the appeal." Bernie Siegel's loud laughter broke the tension. "Jeff, go home. Run 5 miles, have a beer, and take it from me, from the one person who has never misled you, there isn't going to be any appeal." Jeffrey MacDonald stayed up late that night, watching Saturday Night Live on TV. For 81% of the people contacted by the Duke psychology professor to have said yes, they had heard of the case involving Dr. Jeffrey MacDonald, was extraordinary. In such random samplings, it is rare for 81% of those polled to be able even to identify the President of the United States. It seemed likely that for the remaining 19%, unawareness ended on Sunday morning, with the publication of a front-page story in the Raleigh News and Observer. The article was accompanied by pictures of Jeffrey MacDonald in the company of his colorful West Coast attorney, Bernie Siegel, and by old pictures of Colette and Kimberly and Kristen, and by a photograph of the boarded-up exterior of 544 Castle Drive, the murder scene still sealed after 9.5 years, pending final adjudication of the case. As the date for trial neared, the story said, more and more people had begun to drive slowly up and down Castle Drive, staring. The woman who now lived next door to what had been the MacDonald apartment was quoted as saying she couldn't sleep for a week after being informed of what had happened there. An Associated Press story printed in the Sunday paper in nearby Durham, portrayed Jeffrey McDonald as a man who lived the good California life, complete with posh condominium, stewardess, sports car, and boat. The story also quoted Bernie Siegel as having said that he'd wanted the trial moved from Raleigh to a hip, sophisticated community because God knows how a redneck stands, a remark which Siegel denied having made. A television crew was stationed outside the Kappa Alpha house, hoping to film a glimpse of McDonald if he emerged. News broadcasts featured hourly reports on the impending trial, even though jury selection had not yet begun. For a final review of selection procedures, the Duke professor arrived at Kappa Alpha early Sunday afternoon. Clearly, Jeffrey McDonald was still concerned. "The thing that keeps me awake nights," he said, "is how valid are our starting premises. Suppose we're wrong." Once again, Bernie Siegel spoke with reassurance. This was science. This could not fail. "Besides," he said, beginning to chuckle as he lit a pipe, "I intend to provide you with the ultimate safeguard, at great sacrifice to every principle I hold most dear. I will wear a Confederate flag in my lapel." The mood remained upbeat all afternoon. Some of the Kappa Alpha boys brought in a keg of beer and 2 dozen steaks and hosted an early evening barbecue. Wade Smith came over with his banjo. Songs were sung. Jokes were told. Jeffrey McDonald basked in the attention. It felt more like the kickoff of a political campaign, with McDonald, of course, as the candidate, than it did the eve of a trial for the murder of a pregnant woman and 2 little girls. By late evening, McDonald's mother had brought out an album of family snapshots and was showing people what Jeff had looked like in California when he'd grown a beard. As the keg of beer neared its bottom, giddiness began to prevail. Wade Smith could be overheard telling the Duke psychologist that he had neglected to ask the one most important question of all. "Have you ever been the victim of a homicide?" It took 3 days to pick the jury. 7 men, 5 women, all but one of them white, all but one the same one, with at least some college education. Half were over the age of 40. Included were 2 accountants, a chemist, the son of a socially prominent Raleigh physician, a former Green Beret sergeant from Fort Bragg, a former North Carolina state policeman, and a woman whose son, during the school year, resided at the Kappa Alpha house. Midway through the process, Jeffrey McDonald said, "Every time Bernie stands up to accept one of them, I feel another nail being hammered into my coffin." Both Siegel and the Duke psychologist, however, were delighted with the makeup of the jury. "Take the former highway patrolman," Siegel explained. "The prosecution wanted him because he used to be a cop. But we wanted him for a better reason, because we're going to show that the evidence in this case was so badly screwed up that no decent cop would want to be associated with it." And even McDonald was vastly relieved at the inclusion of a former Green Beret. "The tie is so strong, you'd walk across water for one another," he said. "There is no stronger bond. So at the very worst," here he laughed nervously, "I know I've got at least a hung jury." Freddie and Mildred Kassab were in the courtroom throughout the process of jury selection, sitting side by side in the 2nd row on the right, across the aisle from, though not acknowledging the presence of, Jeffrey McDonald's mother, just as they had sat across the aisle from her 16 years earlier in that small Catholic church in Greenwich Village. Kassab, stocky and florid, sat fanning himself with a prosecution floor plan of the interior of 544 Castle Drive. His wife, pinched and small, sat next to him, staring straight ahead in silence. Occasionally, Freddie, his arm around her, would lightly stroke her shoulder with his thumb. Less than 10 yards from the Kassabs, after all the years of being separated from them by 3,000 miles, sat Jeffrey McDonald. He was, as instructed, wearing a conservative, well-tailored suit. For the most part, he too stared straight ahead, his face impassive. From time to time, as a prospective juror was being questioned, and as the Duke professor was handing up a card with a final rating, he would bend to consult with his attorneys. At the end of the third day, with the 12 jurors and 4 alternates finally seated, McDonald, carrying a briefcase, walked down the center aisle toward the rear door. Freddie Kassab had just stepped out into the lobby to speak to reporters. By sheer chance, McDonald reached the door at the same moment as Mildred Kassab. For the first time in more than 8 years, their eyes met. He glanced away immediately. They did not speak. Her gaze, in which both immense pain and raw hatred were apparent, followed him as he walked out the door. Driving back to the Kappa Alpha house, McDonald said that of course he had seen her, and that he had been very tempted to speak to her. "I wanted to say something like, 'I hope you get through this okay,' but I was afraid she'd probably take it the wrong way." In the next day's paper, Mildred was quoted as saying, yes, she had seen him too. "The only thing I could think of," she said, "was Colette, clumsy with her 5 months pregnancy, trying to get away from him." No, she said, she had not been tempted to speak. What was I supposed to say? Good luck? Chapter 3. Victor Warheide had dropped dead of a heart attack while walking to a corner store to buy a bottle of Tabasco sauce in October of 1975. To prosecute the case in his stead, the Justice Department had chosen James L. Blackburn, an assistant U.S. attorney from Raleigh. Blackburn was a short, cordial, soft-spoken man whose silvery gray hair and open boyish face seemed to blend wisdom and innocence. He, like Wade Smith, was a native of North Carolina. He had, in fact, grown up on the campus of Wake Forest University, where his father had served as Methodist chaplain and from which he himself had later graduated. Blackburn's courtroom demeanor was not that of a bloodthirsty prosecutor seeking headlines, but of a quiet country man with a sad but inevitable duty to perform. One could, without stretching the imagination unduly, picture Blackburn as a courteous young aide to General Lee at Appomattox. Even Bernie Siegel, whose contempt for both Judge Dupree and for Blackburn's Justice Department colleague, Brian Murtaugh, was boundless, admitted that Blackburn struck him as a decent man. "Twisted and wrong," Siegel said, "but decent." Blackburn was 34 years old. He had a 2-year-old son named Jeffrey and a daughter who was just 2 months old. This was the first murder case he'd ever prosecuted. For 4 weeks, the prosecution presented its evidence before Judge Franklin T. Dupree, Jr., a 65-year-old native of nearby Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina. Much of the time was devoted to complex explanations of the circumstantial links that bound McDonald to the commission of the crimes. Though he had Brian Murtaugh, with all his knowledge at his side, Blackburn's early presentation seemed tentative and occasionally confused. At the end of the first week, in fact, a wire service story reported that the case against McDonald was off to a shaky start. The testimony was sometimes gruesome, particularly that of the pathologists, whose autopsy descriptions were accompanied by slides of the bodies designed to emphasize the severity of the injuries sustained. A great deal of the evidence was highly technical, and every bit of it was challenged, point by point, by Bernie Siegel, who, with waving arms and a voice by turns booming and coldly sarcastic, went after prosecution witnesses like a German shepherd mauling a jogger. Just as in 1970, every investigative blunder was exposed. The jurors, who sat silently and attentively through the long, draining days, learned, as had Colonel Rock in 1970, that the flower pot had been stood up by a military policeman, that Jeffrey McDonald's wallet had been stolen from under the eyes of the MPs, that the lieutenant had failed to send a patrol to look for the woman standing in the shadows, that the garbage had been emptied, the Esquire magazine read, the bedroom telephone handled, the bloody footprint destroyed, the toilet flushed, the children's fingerprints never taken, other fingerprints poorly photographed and inadvertently destroyed, Jeffrey McDonald's pajama bottoms thrown away, McDonald himself interviewed at the hospital while heavily sedated, and that a known sample of McDonald's hair had actually come from a pony. 9.5 years later, Bernie Siegel's imagery was still intact. "They came in like a herd of circus elephants," he said of the MPs, implying strongly once again that no valid inferences could be drawn from physical evidence so poorly preserved. Throughout this phase of the trial, the defense was exultant. Each day, Wade Smith would leave the courtroom, and while declining to comment publicly, would privately express an ever-growing sense of confidence. "I can see it on their faces," he would say. "The jury can't believe that Jeff is even here. A wonderful day. We did nothing but gain. This is not going to be as hard as we thought." Even McDonald himself grew so confident that he began to give interviews to the press. He was aware, he told one reporter, that some people found his apparent lack of emotion disturbing. "There's no question," he said, "it would be better for me if I were so distraught I could hardly get to court every day. But I think the jury will see the real me when I testify. I hope they understand that not everyone wears their heart on their sleeve." Still, it appeared to another interviewer that most of his answers, even when asked about his feelings, are given matter-of-factly, almost coldly, as if he were speaking about someone else. Only when he began to discuss his tormentors did McDonald show sparks of real feeling, and that feeling appeared to be anger. It took them 6 months behind closed doors, without a defense, to get a grand jury to issue an indictment. If that doesn't tell a normal person something, that normal person isn't thinking. "I've testified whenever they've asked. I've given them whatever they've wanted. And here we are on trial on false charges 9 years later because of the mindless, middle-level federal bureaucracy, with people like Brian Murtaugh who run around without any controls." A competent superior, McDonald said, would have halted the prosecution before it had even gone to a grand jury, much less to trial. "Sure, I'm bitter," he said. "They're building careers on my case, but the truth has to come out sometime. They can't keep lying forever." McDonald said he could not conceive of a conviction. That, he said, would be the Alfred Hitchcock ending to the horror story. To some observers, however, there were indications that McDonald was drawing at least as close to a pair of handcuffs as he was to a chilled bottle of celebratory champagne. It was not possible to assess the impact of the government's presentation upon the jury, except to note that none of the jurors seemed entirely unmoved by the sheer horror and sadness of it all. But Judge Franklin Dupree was proving considerably more scrutable. Judge Dupree, who had been appointed to the federal bench in 1971 by Richard Nixon, was possessed of an unusually mobile, expressive face, and from the earliest days of the trial, the expression most often seen upon it as Bernie Siegel conducted cross-examination was one of distaste. Obviously alert, attentive, and sometimes even taking notes during Jim Blackburn's direct examination, the judge would lean back in his chair with his eyes closed, grimacing in exasperation or rubbing his temples as if his head ached during those periods when Siegel was repetitively questioning a prosecution witness. With even casual spectators openly remarking on the judge's expression, it seemed only logical to assume that it would, to some degree, indicate to the jurors where his sympathies, or lack of sympathy, lay, and possibly even suggest to some where their own belonged. It was not by body language alone, however, that Judge Dupree seemed to be placing obstacles along Jeffrey McDonald's path to freedom. His rulings on several major evidentiary motions did much to shape the course of the trial. He ruled, for example, over Bernie Siegel's spirited objections, that the prosecution would be permitted to read extensively from the March 1970 issue of Esquire magazine. "The government," Siegel argued to the judge at a bench conference, "has suggested that because there was an Esquire magazine in which an article appeared about the Sharon Tate murders, that therefore this placed some idea in the defendant's mind. Your Honor, we only need to trot out all the newspaper clippings. I mean, you would have to be probably a three-toed sloth hanging upside down in a tree to have lived in America in 1969-70 and not heard of the Sharon Tate and LaBianca murders. I mean, this is not a fact that has any special inference to be drawn. You know, when I buy a subscription to Harper's, I take whatever junk they send me, the good and the bad. Am I supposed to have the inference that just because there is something in there, that I chose it? Not at all. You get that with a subscription. You get a magazine. You get a subscription to it. It comes in regularly. The government says, aha! From that fact, we wish the jury to draw the conclusion that he read it. That in fact he read all the things that they say. That in fact it was the source of information. It was the idea. There is just no conceivable way that makes logical sense. I mean, it imputes to the magazine some kind of compelling power, some kind of magic that the editors of this magazine and all others wish they had. It is just simply too remote to be sensibly put into this trial. I mean, it almost has the character of fantasy. Take an intelligent man. No one has to prove that MacDonald is intelligent, that he was literate, read newspapers, and knew what was going on in the world. And because he has a magazine subscription, and they have chosen the article, what about all the other articles? Do we now get to introduce everything he had read in that last year? Love thy wife. Be kind to thy children. How happy it is in America. Can we introduce all that, Your Honor? Why not? Put that idea in his mind, too. To love his family and care for them. Why isn't that fair game? We will be reading Esquire magazine, Your Honor, for quite a while, if the government is allowed to do this. We should also be entitled to show everything else he read within a reasonable time frame that would reflect on his state of mind. Why not all the chapters in the Bible that he read? Why not? That goes to his state of mind. Without pointing out that it was Kiss Me Deadly by Mickey Spillane and not the Bible that MacDonald had been reading in the time frame that immediately preceded the murders, Jim Blackburn argued for the relevancy of the Esquire material. We have done an analysis of those articles, he said. And we know also what the defendant has said these people said. Acid and rain, groovy, kill the pigs. A girl with long blonde hair, carrying a candle, this sort of thing. Now, if the government's theory is correct, there were no such individuals. If there were no such individuals, they had to be invented from somewhere. Because these magazine articles were read by the defendant, and that has been shown by some of the fingerprints that were found on those articles, and of course Ron Harrison has said in his grand jury testimony that MacDonald had read it and said it was wild or something like that, it does show that MacDonald was aware of those articles. And I think that when you look at the articles and see that the word acid, the word rain, the word pig, a girl with long hair, and candles are in those articles. Groovy? The judge asked. I think so, sir, Blackburn replied. Groovy. What does that mean? The judge asked. Far out, Brian Murtaugh interjected. Then Blackburn continued. I do think, Your Honor, that it is probative to the government's theory of the case and the fabrication of the story. I'm not suggesting that he read it first, necessarily, and then got the idea. I would suggest that perhaps what happened is the killings took place, and he remembered the article and used it. And that is where some of these words and things come from. The fabrication of the defendant's story could well have come from his having read the article a short time before these murders occurred. Mr. Siegel says that everybody who knew anything, up to and including the three-toed sloth, the judge said, use those same words, because every time you picked up a paper, there they were. I have no recollection of having read them, and I take four daily newspapers and have for about 15 years. I remember something about the Manson case, but I don't read murder cases. The word acid, Your Honor, is part of our vernacular, Siegel said. It is found in dictionaries. You are from California, the judge interrupted. I'm not sure the word acid is common parlance in Johnston County and Warren County and Harnett, the places where these jurors come from. Some of them are sophisticated enough to have heard the term LSD and the use of acid as synonymous with it, but I'm not so sure about that. In 1970, Siegel said, when this case was first brought, I was not from California. I was from Philadelphia, and even in Philadelphia, we had heard of those things, and we were among the last to get the word on anything. Your Honor, Brian Murtaugh interposed, the articles in the Esquire magazine are not limited solely to the Manson killings. There are additional articles which involve an interview by a reporter of a witch in California. Apparently, they have such things in California. At least, they did at that time. They don't have anything but pretty girls now, Judge Dupree said, at least judging from the ones they bring here. This was a reference to one of Bernie Siegel's young assistants, with whom the judge had recently enjoyed a game of tennis. Her charms notwithstanding, he allowed the prosecution to read all that it wanted to of the March 1970 issue of Esquire magazine to the jury. Siegel's bitterest and most significant evidentiary struggle during this phase of the trial concerned the admissibility of Paul Stombaugh's work with the blue pajama top. It was Siegel's contention that Stombaugh's work had been invalid and was unworthy of submission. The demonstration that he did in the laboratory did not replicate in any reasonable fashion the facts that were known, Siegel argued. The most transparent failure is that the demonstration does not bear any resemblance to the physical facts of the case. This was not an experiment designed by a forensic scientist to prove a point. It was a lawyer's idea of how to prove an argument. That is, can you make 48 holes in the blue pajama top fit into 21 holes in Mrs. McDonald's chest? That Stombaugh had not included in his alignment the ice pick holes in Colette's own pink pajama top was, Siegel said, a fatal flaw. Since that ice pick, as it penetrated her chest, would obviously have had to pass through that garment as well. A second flaw, Siegel charged, was that no evidence supported the contention that the pajama top, as refolded in the FBI laboratory, was in the same position in which it had first been found at the crime scene. If there are no facts to prove that the garment was in this position, Siegel said, then the fact that you could make 48 holes go into 21 holes, ignoring, of course, the pink pajama top, proves what? It proves I can juggle two oranges. But what does that mean to this court? If two oranges being juggled have no relevance, the fact that I can do it has no place in the record of this case. It is a demonstration for the sake of a demonstration. It is not a demonstration for the sake of illuminating the proof of this case. You just can't say that everything in the world can be given to the jury. There are limits that the rules of evidence have placed even on the government's theory of the case, and I want to see those properly invoked. The potential for prejudice here is so substantial that it is unfair to the defendant to permit this. In response, Brian Murtaugh said, we are not saying, and Mr. Stombaugh will not testify, that the top was in precisely the same position as it was found on her body. The government, Jim Blackburn added, contended only that Stombaugh had refolded the garment generally the way it appeared in crime scene photographs, with the right sleeve folded inside out and the left panel, which contained no puncture holes, trailing off alongside the body. At that, Bernie Siegel erupted. At the grand jury, Stombaugh said he folded it exactly as it appeared in the pictures. That is his word, exact. If you try to back away from it now, his skin will be flayed all over this courtroom. Ignoring the outburst, Blackburn calmly reiterated for Judge Dupree the government's view of the significance of the pajama top. There were three types of blood found on it, the majority the type A blood of Colette. At least some of that blood was on it before it was torn. McDonald had said he'd placed it on his wife's body. The top had 48 puncture holes in it. The doctors had testified that McDonald had no ice pick wounds. Colette, however, had 21 puncture holes in her chest. A pathologist had testified that these had been inflicted while her body was in a stationary position. Likewise, the absence of tearing around the circumference of the holes indicated that they had been made while the garment was stationary. Now, if the defendant himself didn't go to bed that night before with a pajama top with 48 holes in it, Blackburn said, then how did those holes get in that pajama top? Colette's pink pajama top, Blackburn argued, had not been included in the reconstruction simply because it was not relevant. Of course there would have been holes in Colette's pajama top. She had been wearing it when she was stabbed. The point of Stambaugh's demonstration had been to determine whether the physical evidence would support the contention that the ice pick holes had been made in the blue pajama top after Jeffrey McDonald had placed it on the body of his wife. Because if we can show this, Blackburn said, we show that it is totally and utterly inconsistent with his own story. Is it prejudicial? Yes, I would say it is. That is precisely why we seek to introduce it. I don't think it is erroneously prejudicial. I think it shows, frankly, that his story is wrong and that it is at variance with the facts as we know them today. Judge Dupree agreed to let the jury hear Stambaugh's explanation of what he had done with the torn blue pajama top and to allow him to describe the conclusions to which his work had led him. He took a less tolerant view, however, of the relevance of Colonel Rock's report on the 1970 military hearing, the report which concluded that the charges against McDonald were not true. I am concerned about the confusion which may arise in the minds of the jurors if this kind of evidence is admitted, the judge said during another bench conference. Won't a jury say, how can this man be not guilty in the Army and be guilty in this court? Won't an argument appeal to the jury that, in the Article 32 proceeding, there was only required to be a finding of probable cause to prosecute? If a 4-month trial there didn't result in even that marginal finding, then how on earth can we, the jury, wouldn't they say on virtually the same evidence that this man is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? It was for precisely this reason, of course, that Siegel wanted so badly to have the Rock Report introduced as evidence. But to do so, Judge Dupree continued, would be to suggest to the jury that a valid judicial proceeding had already occurred and had led to a finding of not guilty. The entire trial then would be invalid under the constitutional protection against double jeopardy. Since, however, the double jeopardy argument had already been made, unsuccessfully, by the defense prior to trial, no suggestion that the charges against McDonald had been not true in 1970 should be allowed to influence the jury's decision in 1979. To admit the Rock Report, Dupree concluded, would be to imply that on this evidence no jury could find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and for that reason he excluded it. An even more serious blow to the defense was dealt when Dupree ruled that no psychiatric testimony could be admitted at trial. In July, prior to trial, Bernie Siegel had arranged for McDonald to be questioned for 6 hours in the office of a Beverly Hills hypnotist. The entire session had been videotaped. Siegel had then edited the videotape and had brought a 90-minute version with him to Raleigh, hoping to be able to show it to the jury. One evening at the Kappa Alpha House, he screened it for a very small audience, which included a forensic psychiatrist from the University of North Carolina. The psychiatrist had already examined McDonald and had written a 24-page report, which he ended by saying, "On the basis of my clinical experience as a psychiatrist and criminologist, and on the basis of my knowledge of theories and research into the area of violence, I would conclude that there is only an extremely remote possibility that a person of his type would commit a crime of this type. Certainly, no one with Dr. McDonald's personality organization has ever been known to commit such a crime." It was Siegel's intent to have both the Chapel Hill psychiatrist and Dr. Sadoff from Philadelphia testify regarding the improbability of Jeffrey McDonald's having murdered his family, and then to have the jury watch the videotape of McDonald, under hypnosis, actually reliving the night of the crimes. The tape began with McDonald giving a description of the intruders far more